This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. North Carolina's new poet laureate grew up in Pittsburgh, so it's a testament to his passion for the Tar Heel State that Joseph Bethanty was selected to be our literary ambassador. Joseph came to North Carolina in the 1970s as a Vista volunteer and immediately fell in love with our landscape, food, and culture. So he stayed. Now, decades later, he is poet laureate. So, besides his duties as professor of creative writing at Appalachian State, he'll spend the next 2 years extolling the virtues of rhyme and reason. And he joins me in the studio now. Joseph Bethanty, first, congratulations and welcome to the State of Things.
Thank you so much, Frank. It's my pleasure to be here.
What are you going to do? What does the laureate do?
The job description says that I'm the ambassador of literature for North Carolina, which is a giant mantle, certainly, to cloak oneself with. And I think what that means is that I serve as kind of a promoter of literature, literacy, writing across the state, that I'll be traveling into schools and hospitals and prisons, colleges, libraries, you name it, anybody really who calls me to come. And I'm also going to have a signature project during my 2-year tenure, and that is a project where I will work with returning combat vets, really all vets and their families, to tell their stories really through poetry and probably through other genres too, if that's applicable.
Well, tell us about your coming here to North Carolina as a Vista volunteer.
I grew up in Pittsburgh, went to undergraduate and graduate school at the University of Pittsburgh. And when I finished with my master's degree, I had a master's degree in English literature, which wasn't worth much in 1976, although it was worth quite a bit to me. And I didn't really want to do the things that I thought I was supposed to do, if that makes any sense. I wanted to make a difference. I wasn't sure what a difference would be. So I just threw my name into the hat of VISTA, which is Domestic Peace Corps. And because I was a generalist, meaning that I had no specific skill, I wasn't a plumber, I wasn't a physician, I wasn't a nurse, I was just sent to North Carolina to work in the North Carolina Department of Correction. So I was sent to Atlanta, where I spent a week training, and then we dispersed to our various projects. So I always like to say that one minute I was in my mother's kitchen and the next minute I was in a prison yard. That's how abrupt the change seemed to me.
And what were you doing in that prison yard?
You know, we were doing a lot of teaching, even though I, for one, didn't really know what teaching meant at that time. A lot of literacy skills, GED, ABE. I started 2 Alcoholics Anonymous chapters. I coached a basketball team and a softball team. We took guys out on work release interviews, arranged study release through the community college. We did a number of those kinds of things that the prison system really didn't have anybody employed specifically to do those kinds of things.
Did that seem interesting to you? Was that something you would have chosen if VISTA let you choose your
I don't know profession? That I would have chosen that. My first choice was to go to Montana, only because Montana seemed like a cool place to go. But once I got involved, I became instantly fascinated. I wanted to be a writer, and a prison yard is just crawling with stories and outrageous, outlandish things that happen minute to minute. And I realized, too, that I don't know. I don't want to say I had an affinity with those men that I was working with, but I felt like I understood them in a lot of ways. And as much as anything, it evangelized me being there among them. I have this kind of theory that those folks who end up doing time, just like men and women who go into combat, they're taking my place in some ways. So I felt a kind of debt to them, if that makes any sense. Although I don't want to minimize how dangerous prisons really are and just the circumstances under which those folks live. So it was really an eye-opening experience and really kind of started the fire under me to develop the habit of writing.
Well, you know, it's interesting that you would say that about people in prison. Somebody in combat is, in a sense, taking your place. They're defending your freedom and your rights and all of that. Why are they taking your place in prison?
It's a kind of crazy epistemological thing I've worked out in my head. I think it's a kind of odd guilt over being so fortunate, if you will. When we walk by homeless people sometimes on the street, it's kind of but for the grace of God in a lot of ways. And they're also the thrown away folks in our society, the people who are in prison, the people who are in shelters, you know, in a lot of ways too, you know, even the folks who go off to war to protect our country in some ways.
Were you writing by this time? You said you wanted to be a writer. Were you writing?
I was kicking it around. I hadn't developed what I like to call the habit of art. In there, I'm quoting Flannery O'Connor. I was still under the delusion that you waited for inspiration to hit, and it came upon you like the burning bush, and you sat down, it poured out of you in liquid fire, and that's the way people wrote. And I was disabused of that rather quickly because I wasn't getting any words down on paper. And I think it's a matter of maturity in a lot of ways, too. You begin to grow up and you realize that if you want to build a wall, you have to begin gathering the stones and stacking them on top of one another.
You met the woman who would become your wife. She was a Vista volunteer.
She was. That, of course, was the most momentous aspect of my journey south. And it is a great story. We met on the very first day of training in Atlanta, Joan's hometown, and we were seated next to each other at breakfast. And I got my breakfast, and I recognized everything on the plate except for the grits. I really didn't know what they were. I had heard of grits, and Joan sensed my puzzlement and coached me through how you seasoned them, how you ate them, and warned me that I better not put sugar in them or refer to them as cream of wheat, since she had her eyebrows raised at all Yankees at that time.
But the half pound of butter, that was fine.
That's correct.
So, and you say she was from Atlanta. So did she become then your guide to the South?
Yes. That's nice of you to put it that way. I didn't really realize that at all, but she was my guide to the South in a lot of ways. I was a foreigner in a lot of ways, and I loved the South from the beginning, but when you're from another place, people recognize you as being from another place. So I didn't want to speak because everyone knew that I wasn't from around there. So I would always ask Joan if we were driving somewhere and didn't know where we were going to get out and ask for directions. And of course, she introduced me to her family, and I have an entire Southern family now, these 36 years. So she really has been. The language I've picked up from her, the names of wildflowers, any number of things, cuisine, you name it. So it's been a lovely meld of our two cultures.
And yet you're still not asking directions, are you?
I'm not.
There you go. It had nothing to do with your accent. Well, how about, I've read that you really fell in love with North Carolina kind of at first sight as well.
You know, I don't know what it was exactly. It was so beautiful, and I don't know if it's every city kid's dream to live in the country and have woods and streams and the way we might idealize that and romanticize that in our minds, but it just seems so right. I ended up living in Charlotte, so I came straight from Pittsburgh to Charlotte, and that transition was just completely seamless for me for some reason. And this is in 1976. Charlotte was at that time a charming village rather than a charming large city at the time. I met so many like-minded people, a lot of my Vista cronies who had escaped their lives in the same way that I had. I found it a terrifically friendly state. Charlotte was wonderfully friendly. And while I was always a citizen of Pittsburgh and did not know anything outside of my hometown, much outside my neighborhood, to tell you the truth, I found out quickly when you live in North Carolina, you're a citizen of a state, which was really unusual. And I've traveled so extensively to every nook and cranny, and I'm looking forward to revisiting those nooks and crannies. And that just didn't happen when I grew up. So I don't know if that's the fabric of the city kid who can't fight his way outside of his neighborhood and outside of his city.
So tell me now, when did you actually start writing poetry?
You know, I started kicking it around in high school, maybe the way a lot of kids kick it around in high school. And I have to tell this shameful story on myself. Two things occurred in high school when I was 16 in 1969. One was that the pretty radical African-American poet Don Lee visited our high school. How and why, I have no earthly idea, because he was kind of a Molotov cocktail thrown into the midst of 1,200 boys in coats and ties. His name now is Haki Mahabuti, and he's still really a very prominent poet. He came and read to us, and I have reimagined him as about 7'8", but I do remember that he had this very flamboyant dashiki on in this enormous afro. And he was really a forerunner of performance poetry in a lot of ways, because he really put his heart and soul into these poems and gesticulated and shouted these poems and performed them. And they were really pretty provocative, unusual poems. And we had never seen anything like it. Our jaws just fell to the auditorium floor. That same year, although there was something very seductive about what he was doing, you know, something kind of taboo that we were all drawn to, that very same year, my high school, again, Pittsburgh Central Catholic, a school that my mother referred to as a private school for Catholic hoodlums, I might add, which I always got a kick out of.
Well, I went to one of those, too. We can compare scars after this.
Exactly.
Go ahead.
That year, Central produced a literary magazine called Spectrum, and there were probably 2,000 Spectrums across the United States, since that was a very far-out Aquarian name, I suppose. Mm. And a lot of guys I knew published poems in the magazine, and when those poems came out in the magazines, those guys were just the object of adulation from all the beautiful, brilliant girls in the various Catholic satellite schools around. And I was so envious and realized then that I needed to, you know, trade in my football helmet for some poetry.
Little known fact that poetry does attract Catholic girls. This is something we're going to keep between the two of us. But it's a real chick magnet, isn't it?
You know, I hesitate to say that, but it could be in the right hands.
Will you read a poem for
us? I'd love to. This is from my book called Land of Amnesia. It's the title poem, and it's set in Anson County, where we lived for 3 years, where really a lot of my poems are set. And Anson County is really the heart of my Southern imagination. Land of Amnesia. I swear, given even this much of a fool's chance, at the end I'd beg to cross one last time the rocky river into Anson County. I'd ask you to come, and if you'd so consent, I'd forswear tobacco and shun drink. But the bill of sale this time would be forever. No last-minute dickering over the route, no trips to the conjure woman like Lot's lying wife. I'll not have you looking back. We'll hold Jesus to his writ promise of forgiveness, not in such tongue as folks might reckon, but signs, bodement, two nights of bloody sun over All Souls Church, shades in the vesture of deer, your hand in mine atop Lord Anson's Bible. Over Cedar Hill and Pinkston would shin the tar roads and foxtrots, quit or quit, but for snakes and oat grass. Even a mincing moon off cotton will yield light enough to walk by. In the morning I'll be there with sweet milk. We'll watch the sun break out of the crop shroud like a mourning baby, lustering the break, wild banshee turkey sailing out of it. If we make Brownie's trailer by lunch, he'll put us up something, field peas and hoe cakes, blueberry honey. From his firmament the Lord will fix us in the crosshairs of his holy roads, 109 and 1634, Big Davis on the shoulder, black as old roadbed, hitching into Wadesboro for a jug of wine at the shot house, a game of nine-ball clacking out the open door of Deese's speakeasy, two mule carts and a pickup with a tethered blue tick chalked in the gravel. From here it's not but a mile and a half to the infallen arsoned house where we first whelped. But you were bound to be frighted. It gets fen and swampy. River runs under this murmury ground. You can smell the charred heart pine, turpentine wood boiled out in the fire. Pitch so fast and instant, bird flocks that lit there singing still roost by their petrified bones. Nailed across the door is a whiffle tree. Mrs. Little's thorns still thrive. The old bay star dead 2 decades canters in the pasture. Cotton fetches 2 bits of bale. In the sky dart lights of other craft. There's no one we can tell about this. No one who would ever allow it. Behind us pitches the crazed compass needle, our lives of other counties long forgotten, burnt up like hair locks in a candle. It is here, my best beloved, we'll build on ruin.
Joseph Bethanty, North Carolina's new poet laureate. And it's a beautiful poem, and it is evocative of the landscape and the culture of North Carolina. Certainly landscapes in place inform and inspire a poet and writer. But have you ever thought that you might not have been a writer if it hadn't been for a place? Or can you just take the craft and the talent that you have and it would just be another place you're reflecting? To what extent does the place make you the poet?
I harp like crazy to my students about place because I really think place authenticates voice. And there are 2 places that I write about. And those places are Pittsburgh, my hometown, in North Carolina. One of the great blessings of coming to North Carolina is that I'm not the one-note Johnny I would have been. I would have written and written and written about Pittsburgh, Pittsburgh, Pittsburgh. And I could continue to do that my whole life, but it's so wonderful to have this other life, this other world, this other family. It's impossible, I feel like, to live in a state like North Carolina that is so rural and travel through it as much as I have without your sense of the aural, what you hear, and also without having your eye retrained. And somehow that ear and eye end up influencing your voice, your whole psyche, what seems important, what you become obsessed by, what you think to write about.
Joseph, what a pleasure talking with you. Thanks so much for being on the program.
My great pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Joseph Bethanty is North Carolina's new poet laureate. For more information on his books and his upcoming projects, go to ncarts.org. Coming up after a short break, a young adult novel that exposes the true strangeness of suburbia. Stay with us on The State of Things.